Alright, we're going to look at the 12th chapter of Matthew. Last week we kind of summarized for you a little bit who this Matthew character was. Identified him as a tax collector, was transformed by Christ into a fairly decent human being. And he turned out to be a pretty good fellow. He wrote this book under the inspiration of the Lord. Now, one of the things that was very, very prominent in not only Matthew's account, but the other disciples' account, was the realism of Christ. They were not dealing with a religious thing. They were dealing with reality. Most of religion today, or much of religion today, is an ivory tower thing. It's up in the clouds. I talked to a person just before coming over here, in fact, that had spent all her early years in a particular religious group. I mean, up until she was 18, I guess she never missed a shot at it. But she said to me, it was so easy to set aside because there was nothing there to hold on to. There was nothing in it. Many times religious ideas are nice to hear about, but they don't do anything inside. They don't give you a way to live. They don't help you in the daily routines of life. Matthew and the other disciples were kind of quarried out of the rock. They were not the religious people. They were men that pretty well were of the earth. They were fishermen and they were tax collectors and they were people of that type who had their feet on the ground pretty well, were not looking for visionary ideas. And this whole thing made sense to them. They were business people, made sense to business people. There were soldiers. It made sense to the soldiers. The meaning of life that Christ presented was realism. I like the expression, you know that, but I don't know a better one to say it was realism right at the gut level. It was right where we are at. Now this 12th chapter of Matthew talks about something in that vein. It has to do with reality rather than religion. There is a bumper sticker out that says that Christianity is not a religion, it's a relationship. Just as in your marriage, if your marriage is any good at all, you don't see it as an institution, you see it as a personal relationship. If you're talking about your wife, you're not saying, this is my marriage partner. This is my wife. We have a happy institution. Oh, we have a happy relationship. If it is happy, maybe it isn't. But if it is, that's what you talk about. You know, it's a personal relationship. In the matter of the tie between these men, who were the writers of this book, and Jesus, there was a relationship. And then after Christ, according to the scriptures, died on the cross and rose again, it was more than even a relationship. It was a vital unity of spirit. The spirit of God tied to the spirit of man. That, of course, was one of the reasons for Christ going back into heaven, as we may say, or going back to his position in the Godhead, because as long as he was on the earth, he was the companion of these men. He was with them all the time, but he was not in them. After he returned to glory, his spirit then came to be in them. This is the thing these disciples were talking about, a vital personal relationship. This ran counter to the religious theme of the day. Jesus was among the Pharisees, the religious zealots. The Jewish religion But it wasn't there was anything wrong with the Jewish religion as such. In fact, Jesus was himself of the Jewish faith. After he died on the cross and rose again, there was a new kind of relationship between God and his people. So from that time on, it was a different thing. The people that came after Christ to be part of God's family had a different kind of relationship. They were neither Jew nor Gentile. They were simply, well, as we say now, people that belonged to Christ. They were Christians. They had his faith. They had his spirit in them. But prior to that time, prior to the establishment of this new relationship of spirit rather than law, Jesus was of the Jewish faith. There was nothing wrong with the Jewish faith at that time, because it was the only line of faith that even professed to have a relatedness to God. The other religions of the day were pagan religions. That is, they were worshippers of the goddess Astarte, the goddess of fertility. They were worshippers of Dagon, the fish god. They were worshippers of Horus, the hawk god. They were worshippers of the pantheon of Roman gods and Greek gods. But the Jewish faith was the one that had its bead set on the supreme being, God. And there was nothing wrong with that. But the problem was the religionists who corrupted the simple faith. They were called Pharisees. They corrupted the simple faith because they took that which was a living relationship and made a legal structure out of it, made a religion out of it, made forms and rituals, which most religion consists of today, a lot of forms and rituals. They may give a person a certain amount of security, but they don't minister very much life. And besides, they put burdens grievous to be borne. That's what Jesus said about these Pharisees. He said, all your little minute laws put a burden on the back of the people. He said, I didn't come to put a burden on their back. I came to help them to live. Thus the Pharisees, for example, who had expanded the law greatly. Now, God gave Moses a law on Mount Sinai. The law was written in tables of stone. It was a rather simple law. You may think that it had a lot of intricacies to it, but really it was pretty simple. The law of Moses. But these Pharisees were the religionists who took that simple law and expanded it into thousands of little minute details. For example, some of you ladies cook. You go to the cupboard and you get a little can of spice out. And you take a pinch of it and put it in your food. The housewife under the Pharisees, every time she put a pinch of seasoning in the food, she had to put another pinch in a little container as a tithe to God. That would make dinner a lot slower than it is, wouldn't it? Every time you took a spoonful of flour, you give it to the, put it in the food, you put a little bit in the bin for God. Now God had said, I want you to give a tenth part of your income. Now that is not something we carry out today. I want to make that clear. Well, as long as we're there, I'm going to make a detour here and say to you, to be very clear about it, the New Testament, the new relationship in Christ does not talk about 10%. The new relationship is that you and God share whatever you have. You know, he gives you what you need and you give to him what you feel that you want to give to him. It's a voluntary thing, totally voluntary. There is a sense in which we are in a marriage relationship to Christ. In a way, the church is called the bride of Christ. Well, when a man and his wife are married, if they have a smooth marriage, they're probably not on a percentage basis. Or the husband gives his wife 10% of his income and measures it out to the nickel or something. They share it. They have it together. Maybe he gives her a budget. I understand that point. That's all right. They need a budget to live on. In the church, you see, it's that way. This idea of saying, okay, here's 10% for God. clutch the rest to our bosom.
It's ridiculous.
We get from him what we need to live on. We buy the things we feel that we want or we need to have. We give to him the things that we feel we give to him, the amount of money we feel that he wants. I have, just as a matter of illustration, there have been times when I have emptied my bank account for the Lord to give to the Lord. And there have been other times when I have not given very much in terms of regular giving. I didn't have it there to give. There were other times when I would, you know, we shared it together, that's all. So I wanted to make that point clear. Now, the Pharisees were so minute about this matter of tithe, and that's only one simple illustration of the law. They had thick volumes defining the law. A Sabbath day's journey, for example. You could go a Sabbath day's journey. How much was that? 600 furlongs. I don't know, maybe it constituted a mile. You couldn't go any further than that on the Sabbath, but you could go that far. They had this thing worked out till it was a great load on the back of the people. Even today, in our modern society, it is impossible to really, for a devout Jew, with all the modern devices we have and all the relative affluence that we have, it is almost impossible for a devout Jew to keep a kosher house, as we call it. In other words, to follow all the rules that the Pharisees had in their day. If you want to have a chicken, you can't just go down to the butcher shop and buy a chicken. You've got to buy a kosher chicken. Chicken doesn't know, but a kosher chicken is one that has to be taken with one stroke of the knife, you know, and things like that. And the kosher butcher shop is set up so that they can try to meet the demands. But I've heard from the horse's mouth, so to speak, I have accompanied with devout Jewish people and some that are not devout, some that have really tried to keep a kosher house, and they said it's just impossible. Even the butcher shop that calls itself a kosher shop is undoubtedly not really kosher in everything. A kosher means doing it exactly right. Well, the Pharisees got themselves in a noose on this thing, and they had these laws so minute that they were just a burden on the back of the people. It happens today. Why do I talk about it? What difference does it make? Because it happens in religion today. As surely as people begin to depart from the simplicities of the Bible, they start laying up the rules. I think the quickest way to tell whether a thing is off base or not is to start counting the rules they've got. They don't dare let you go on your own because you wouldn't go right, so they've got you all corseted and structured and hemmed in by their rules. Now some people like that because they don't want to be told what to do. I guess some people are built that way. They want somebody to tell them when to get up and when to go to bed, when to brush their teeth and when to eat breakfast and all the rest of it. What meetings you can go to and what you can't, what entertainment you're going to have and what you can't, they want somebody to tell them because they haven't got enough life in themselves to tell themselves. All right, that's some background, because right away in this 12th chapter, Matthew is going to talk about this matter. And there was a little story illustrating the point, and in chapter 12, verse 1, at that time, Jesus went on the Sabbath through the grain fields, and his disciples were hungry, and they began to pick the ears, or actually the heads of the wheat. It was probably a kind of wheat, and they just snapped off the head. The King James text says corn, but I don't think they had ears of corn there. They had grain very much like wheat, and they picked the head off and ate that. So they began to pick the, we'll call it ears or grain, and to eat. And the Pharisees saw them and said, "Behold, Your disciples do what is not lawful on the Sabbath. They'd already figured out what you could do on the Sabbath, and they had it listed. They could show them the vehicle code, the chapter and verse. You cannot pick ears of corn on the Sabbath. Now, Moses never said you couldn't, but they said it. They do what's not lawful on the Sabbath. But he said to them, have you never read what David did when he was hungry and those who were with him? How he entered into the house of God and ate the bread of presence or presentation, which it is not lawful for any to eat except the priests only? It was a very interesting story. Here's the temple. In the temple, part of the furnishings included a lampstand, the menorah, as the Jewish people call it today, an altar of incense, where they had incense burning continually, and a table with 12 loaves of bread on it. Now, those 12 loaves of bread had meaning. They represented, on the one hand, the 12 tribes of Israel. They represented, on the other hand, God's nourishing of their lives. The incense represented prayer, the lampstand represented God as the light of the world, and the present, the loaves, as God as the bread of the world. In other words, the nourishment for their soul. But the 12 were there because they represented the 12 tribes of Israel. Very sacred loaves. It would be, in a lot of ways, like what they call the host in the Catholic Church. The elements. And now, this is not against the Catholic Church. I mean, it's saying it's what they call the host, and this is how they would look at it. We have our communion up there at our little place, and we let the children partake with us because we think that the Lord likes the children. We think it's a nice thing for them to enjoy that. I think that some religious people walked into our place, they'd probably turn blue if they saw the way we were handling that. And we think it's a fellowship thing. We think that it is something we do to remember Christ. He asked us to do that. We're not careless with it, but I mean, it's very informal, very casual. Christ just took the elements on the table, you know, and he passed what he had around. He passed a cup of wine that he had on the table. Took a loaf of bread that was there and broke it and passed it around. It was very informal. I don't think they would have fallen off the chair if they dropped it on the floor. Today, if it happened in the Catholic Church or some of the other churches, if they dropped it, they'd be mortified because it means something particular to them. But I'm trying to say that this is the kind of sanctity or sacredness that was attached to these loaves on the table. Well, here came David and his cronies, because he was sort of David was not your typical king. He was also not your typical warrior. He was a jungle fighter, and he had his motley crew coming through there from a fight, and they were hungry, and they came to the temple, and they went in, and they took those loaves of bread out of the temple and ate them. Well, of course, that would mortify these Pharisees. They'd really turn blue if they thought of that. And Christ looked at that and he said, don't you remember what David did back in those days? He went in and ate those loaves right out of the temple. And it's not lawful to eat them. But he said, you know why they ate them? Because they were hungry. Is God more concerned about religious rituals or hunger? Well, he goes on to say that point. He said, did you not read that in the law that the priests break the law every Sabbath and are blameless? What does he mean to break the law? Well, when the priest offers up a sacrifice, he breaks the law by all the work he does, you know. The work he does to offer the sacrifices, Christ is saying you're kind of inconsistent, aren't you? You put all these rules out about your work. Now remember, God didn't put those rules on them. These Pharisees did. I mean, God didn't say anything about how much you could work on the Sabbath and how much you couldn't. So he says, you think that you're doing so great on the Sabbath, but look at the priests. They violate the Sabbath every day, every week. So he kind of had them there on that point. He says, I say to you that one greater than the temple is here. And if you knew what that meant, I will have mercy and not sacrifice, you would not have condemned the guiltless. What he is saying is that the main thing that Christ is building in your heart and mind is love and compassion for others. He is not so much interested in that paragon of virtue as he is in a heart of mercy. Now that does not say that he does not want you to be careful in your conduct. He's saying that all of us are weak. All human beings are weak. And if I make a mistake, you make a mistake. For every mistake you make, I may make two or three. What we need to do is surround one another with love and compassion instead of being so quick to judge each other. I go through a lot of marriage counseling sessions where one of the big problems is right there. I told one, you have become the warden of your husband. You're his mother. No wonder he wants to leave you. He can't stand it anymore. You're more concerned about shaping him up into what you think he ought to be than you are about his person. If you want him to really like you, stay with you. Maybe you ought to start asking yourself whether you care more about him as a person than about shaping him up. So I said, if his problem is that he isn't all that you think he ought to be, your problem is perfectionism. You see, this is a common problem. By the time we get through with each other and married, we've hacked each other up so much that there's nothing left of love. It's all, we've just been hacking away, chopping away. I sat in a home in another part of the state and sat there and listened to the husband and wife chopping each other up. And I said to them, what's going to be left of love? You're sitting there hacking each other to pieces. I've said to them, nobody wants to come home to somebody who, the minute they get in the door, are going to start tearing them apart, telling them all their faults. Well, this is part of our problem. We're lousy in our human relationships because we can't leave each other alone. We just have to always be picking at each other and chopping and saying nasty things about each other and misjudging, all of this sort of thing. Paul says, go for the Spirit. Don't think in terms of what the motive is. Think in terms of what the heart is. Our actions are always pretty hard to handle. We're careless in our actions a lot of times. I will have mercy, not sacrifice. And God is saying, if my child needs a little something to eat, I'm certainly not going to get upset with him for taking off the table of the temple. His person is more important than that. Well, the Lord really got at these Pharisees, and I think religion is its own worst enemy today. I talked to a woman tonight and said, she says, I believe in a supreme being, all right. She said, I don't believe in the Christian God. I don't believe in God the way the Christians have it. I said, what's that? Well, this whiskered grandfather type person. Well, I said, I don't know, maybe that's the way he's taught it, but that's not the way the Bible presents him. Religion has painted its pictures And these pictures are not very appealing to a lot of people. I remember over there in Europe, all the masterpieces on the temple walls, on the walls of the churches. And if I had not had my faith pretty well rooted in God and the Bible, if I'd been kind of hanging on to the church instead, that would have been enough to finish me. Those paintings, they do not give to me a very attractive picture of Christianity, you know, the way they've got them painted out there. Michelangelo may have been a wonderful artist, but he was a lousy theologian. You go into the Vatican, look on the ceiling up there, the Sistine Chapel, you'll see what I mean. That's true of religion today. They don't present a very attractive picture. I mean, they don't present the kind of picture normally that a person can handle in this hard, cold world of reality. Well, Matthew, this old rascal who had been a tax collector gouging his buddies for all these years, Christ finally got hold of him and got him into a position of pretty remarkable faith. But he would never have gotten him on the basis of the old Pharisaical religion. Matthew would never have had any part of that. And I wouldn't have had any part of it. I'm not sure I'm as much a rascal as Matthew was, but I still would not have had any part of that kind of a religious thing. And a lot of thinking people today wouldn't have either. But I think it's very important for us to get the picture of Christ from the Bible, not from religion. All right? And they went over thence into the synagogue. And behold, there was a man with a withered hand. And they asked him, saying, "Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath?" In order that they might accuse him. And these Pharisees were asking him that question because they wanted to trip him up. Interesting word for accuse here. The Greek word is kategoreo. We get our word category from it. The constant tendency of religion is to categorize, to pigeonhole people. You're this, and you're this, and you're this. You're a sinner, you're a reprobate, you're this, and you're this. They want to categorize them. Life is not that simple. But these Jews wanted to classify Christ. They wanted to pin him down. The kind of questions they asked were kind of like the question, "Have you quit beating your wife?" You know, either way, you're in trouble. If you say you quit, that means you used to do it. If you say you haven't quit, it means you still do it. So, I mean, there's no simple answer. That's what it means. Categorizing means pinning people down to too simple an answer. And they were trying to do that to Christ, to Jesus as he was on the earth. He was rather clever. You will find that Christ's answer to these men, to these Pharisees, and they were always dogging his steps. They were like terriers nipping at his heels. Everywhere he went, they had these little Pharisees nipping at his heels, trying to catch him up on something, trip him. You have that in some families, where one is a Christian and another is not. I use the word Christian loosely. I mean, one is a believer and has faith in the Lord, and the other doesn't. And that poor member of the family is the one they're always pointing at, you know, and all they have to do is kick the dog or something, and right away they're a heathen, and, "Aha, I thought you were a Christian," you know. Well, they might slam their thumb in the door and say, "Darn," and somebody says, "Aha, I thought you were a Christian." You see. Always dogging at them like that. That's just common. You may not have run into it, but I have. I've seen it many, many times where everybody's standing around like a bunch of vultures waiting for that tender little lamb to trip themselves up. And that's what they were doing with Christ. But he was a little more clever than they. So he says to them, "All right, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? You tell me, which of you shall have a sheep, and if it falls into a pit on the Sabbath, will not take it and raise it out?" He said, "You're of much more value than than a sheep. Or how much, he actually says, how much rather is a man more valuable than a sheep? So then, it is lawful to do well on the Sabbath. And then he said to the man, stretch out your hand. That was the end of the argument. Because they would not have allowed healing on the Sabbath. And he says, all right, if your sheep falls in the ditch, you're going to let it die? Well, no, we can't let a sheep die in the ditch. Okay, fellow, stretch out your hand. You're the sheep. I'm going to heal you. And he stretched it out, and it was restored, whole as the other. And the Pharisees went out and took counsel together against him how they might kill him. They didn't have any more answers, you know. He really corked them. He just corked them right there. They wanted to kill him. He made these Pharisees so mad that they wanted to kill him. Of course, ultimately they did. But he trapped them. He caught them in their own devices. And Jesus, knowing that they were going to kill him, or feeling that, of course it wasn't too hard to tell, I guess, departed thence. He went away. He didn't stand there and let him kill him. He had more work to do. So he left. Many followed him, and he healed them all. And he charged them that they should not make him known, in order that the word might be fulfilled through Isaiah the prophet, saying, behold, my son whom I have chosen, my beloved one, in whom my soul is pleased, I will put my spirit upon him, and he will proclaim justice to the Gentiles. He will not strive nor cry out, neither shall any hear his voice in the streets. Just that much first. Very, very important. The Bible does not present anywhere a brand of faith that runs crying through the streets. That means that there was never a matter of promotions, of noise, of haranguing. It was a quiet thing. Some people today identify noisiness with godliness. They think the louder they shout, the holier they are. The more ruckus they raise. They're going to go take a band down through Main Street or something. Well, I shouldn't say it that way. Maybe I step on some Salvation Army toes. I don't mean that. They're pretty good band people. I mean, they play a good drum. But we don't associate noise with godliness. Some people think you really haven't been initiated into the faith. You go out in a street corner somewhere and proclaim the word. Well, that was not the basic method of the scripture. It's the modern promoter's method. If you want hawksters, you go to the county fair out there. You got plenty of them. You set your booth up right there with the potato peelers. Draw a crowd. But I'll tell you what, it's done. It's driven an awful lot of people away. In answer to a question we had up at the school one night about why it's necessary to learn all the things we were learning, because we've been going into a lot of side issues of science and history and things like that. And I said to the fellows, I said, well, you know, because their attitude was, well, if you just preach the word and the Holy Spirit will save their souls. I said, well, problem is, I have to pick up all the people that slip out the back door because you haven't answered their questions. They may get 10 people up at the front because of their methods, and 50 are slipping out the door. They're turning them away. Same thing with this shouting business, you know, with some of the promotional techniques of evangelism. The buttonholer on the street and people like that. Sure, maybe they get a handful of people, but what they don't pay attention to are the large numbers that are slipping away because they're being offended by this. I want it to be very clearly known here. Now, see, Paul did not go shouting in the marketplace. Paul did a lot of work in the marketplace, but he sat at the place where people commonly did that sort of thing. He went to the forum. He sat down there and he talked to the people that came to him and wanted to talk about it. He didn't go out and force his attentions upon them. people get the idea in Christianity today that every time you sit down next to somebody in a bus, you've got to interfere with them and tell them about the gospel. Well, I don't know. I don't like to be interfered with either. Maybe we should feel that we ought to be interfered with, but I don't think we have the right to invade another person's privacy, no matter how important we think our message is. The Spirit has many ways of opening up the heart in conversation. You don't have to force it. You never have to force it. You know the way to find out whether you're out of order or not? Very easy test. If you feel uneasy about it, don't. I say that to you without any fear of contradiction from the Lord. He knows what I'm saying. I've been following this for a lot of years, 25, 30 years, you see. And I say to you, contrary to what is put out by religion in a lot of places, or you've got to go out and buttonhole people and you're missing the boat if you don't get everybody that comes to your door and get them saved. I mean, I say to you, if the Lord is in the situation, if he wants that discussion, it'll come about naturally, easily. So I'm going to lay down a rule of thumb, and when you get up to the glory land, you can tell God that I was the one that told you this. If you feel uneasy about it, don't. If it flows naturally, you're all right. You do a good job. And the Lord will be with you. He'll make the setup for you. You don't have to push it. See, Jesus did not run up and down the streets of Jerusalem shouting. Furthermore, it says of him, he will not trample a bruised reed, and a smoking flax he will not quench. That means that the psyche is a fragile thing. It's a fragile thing. You can offend people pretty easily. You can scar them pretty easily. Jesus did not come pounding on people to get them into the faith. I've been in many a meeting, an evangelistic meeting, where somebody up at the front was saying, now, if you walk out that door and you don't take Christ, the roof's going to fall on you, and you'll never get another chance. And Jesus didn't operate that way. Some people come on like a steamroller. Now, that's true in your human relationships, too, you know. If you want to really be helpful to people, don't come on them like a steamroller. We do an awful lot of damage that way. Give people a chance to talk. Give them the benefit of the doubt. I was talking to a young lady this morning, a teenager, 16-year-old. Her father is a lawyer. He has lost, one by one, steadily, his children. Because when he talks to them, they're on the witness stand. I know this. I've known the man for years. His young people just avoid him because they can't talk to him. They try to talk to him and he hammers on them, you know. Why do you say that? How come you said this? And if they don't say it just the way he thinks they ought to say it, he pounces on them. It happens in lots of cases. Families, same way. Communication's a delicate thing, a lot of it's a fragile thing. Especially with young people. If they slam that old door shut, that's it. Bam. You're through. He said to me, you'll never get through to it. You're just like a rock. Can't get anything through it all. For an hour, we had a beautiful conversation back and forth. No problem at all. He was open, honest, discussed her situation. See, Jesus did not come on like a steamroller, rolling over everybody. The Pharisees did. They came trampling everybody like a herd of elephants. A lot of religionists do today. It's another thing to help you decide whether something is true or not. If there's a religion that is true, I mean, if the thing the person is presenting has real merit to it, they're not going to have to pound you with it. Well, it says then, and in his name shall the Gentiles hope. Now there's the picture of Jesus as the Bible gives it. Human, understanding, gentle with people, sensitive to life, merciful.